And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have a fun show for you this evening. We have our guest is Nick Redfern, repeat guest. Always really love having him on the show. He's got a new book. I think he's written 50 books so far on all kinds of interesting topics. And this one is particularly interesting. We're going to be talking about top secret abduction files, what the government may or may not know. He always dives deep into these subjects and should be really fun to talk to him. Before that, I have Alejandro with a special guest visiting him. He's going to be on the show in just a second. And we are live on KGRA Radio. And I want to say hi to everyone over there. I'm getting some email from people over there, so that's always nice. And I'm getting a lot of email from Australia. They're one of the big listeners of the show, and I want to just say a little shout-out to people over there. Stacy, I think, is one person's name. We also have Chris from Tasmania, who has written another blog, and this one is the Valentech UFO incident in Australia. He wrote about that, so check out podcastufo.com, and you'll see the blog is right there. And I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. We absolutely could not do it without you. It's about a break even now, and I really appreciate people helping out. And all right, we're ready to get going. Alejandro, how are you?
Yes, sir. I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. You're kind of an awkward angle. I don't see it. Now I'm the guy with the I have the stars behind me. I don't know if you can see that. I have a new background, not as fancy as yours, but my stars have fold marks in them. So,
copycat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't see them. I can't see you at all, but I assume you're there. I can hear you. And unless it's somebody that is doing a very good impression of you, which I think would be difficult because you have a unique voice.
I do. Wow. I think that's a... Boy, you should be able to see me. It must be your Skype or something, because you're on your iPad or something like that. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm on my iPad.
You have a sidekick. Does a sidekick want to wave hi to us?
It's Mark D'Antonio.
Hey,
Mark.
How you doing, Martin?
How are you, Mark? Good to see you.
And yeah, very nice to hear you. I wish I could see you, but, you know, we'll just blame it on Alejandro, right? Is that what we're supposed to do?
That's what we're always supposed to do, whatever happens. Well, yeah.
Well, he always blames things on me, so that's sort of like paying it forward, I guess.
Yeah, right. So you're visiting Arizona, and actually, are you both going to the event coming up in Baltimore?
I am not going, but I believe he is.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
That's the Alien Con, I believe, down in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. I'll be there.
Yeah. All right. Well,
I'll be there, and I'll be doing three different talks and participating in a panel, so they're going to keep me busy. And we're going to have a UFO Congress booth there where we're going to be selling super cool stuff.
All right. And that's coming right up this weekend, right?
That is the 9th through the 11th. So what?
The weekend after.
Yeah,
following week. Oh, excellent. Okay. So what is going on? Before you start. Just before we start here, you started to tell me that you were going to make something after the show. I don't want you to forget to talk about that. Just remember that. And because I want
once we start talking UFOs, I get excited about UFOs, so you're going to have to remind me. You're
I'll
the host. That's your job.
I'll try. Yeah. All right.
Okay. Write a note.
Yeah. So what's going on?
Okay. I want to get to a couple of things. I'll touch it on this one real quickly just because it's a case that you brought this up on my podcast, actually. And it's an interesting case I had not heard of, but it's in the Baltimore Sun. It's a case that happened 60 years ago in that area, Loch Raven Reservoir, where these two guys were driving in the area in the 50s, and they came across a large saucer in the sky. It actually made their car stop. They got out. It had beamed a light on them and before leaving, and then their car worked. What's great about this case also is that it was a Blue Book case. So it was something that was investigated by the Air Force. Now, they say that this case influenced a lot of UFO research and a lot of UFO research in the area. But I'm not aware. I had not heard of this case before. That's why I think it's pretty cool. But I also think that it's cool that it's in the Baltimore Sun. Of course, I'll be heading there pretty soon, just like you talked about. But, yeah, that's one to check out that people will find on openminds.tv. You know, another thing to mention is you mentioned Valentich, who was his kid, who was a pilot. And that case was something like 40 years ago. I can't remember the exact date, but since you mentioned it, I just wanted to talk about it because there is a story in the media about that one as well, where his girlfriend from the time was mentioned. But just to view that, oh, go over that one real quick. It's really interesting. This kid had just essentially gotten his pilot's license. He was going to do his first solo flight over water. Well, during this flight, he said he was being followed by a large cylindrical glowing object that was flying around his plane, and then he was never heard from again. He nor the plane was ever found. His girlfriend said in this recent article that he was actually worried about his first solo flight over water, so she felt he kind of prophesized what had happened, that something unfortunately negative did happen.
Wow.
But
oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get into another case just because Mark is here, something else that's going on. And I love this because it's always fun to educate the public on great cases, but also to warn them of material that is not credible or is not what it appears to be. So 1952, UFOs flew over Washington, D.C., and actually there was a wave, so there's a period of time. It's one of the best cases out there. In fact, because it had happened and they had flown over National Airport there in Washington, D.C., Blue Book was investigating it, and Captain Ruppelt, whose book you can read on this incident, he goes into it in detail, was out there investigating it. He had to go home, but the weekend after he went home, these things came back, and Blue Book personnel who were there in Washington, D.C., actually went to the control tower and witnessed all of this going down. It sounds much like, you know, stories that you hear through history, including very similar to 2004 in San Diego, what happened to the Nimitz carrier strike group like we hear about. But essentially seeing these white lights, jets are scrambled. When the jets get in the area, these things dart off at very quick speeds. And in this case, it was reported that once the jets left, they came back. So a great case. However, why I'm bringing this up is that you will see this in the UFO news, because what had happened recently is that Tom DeLonge and Lou Elizondo, both of To the Stars Academy, went and spoke in Rome recently. And Luis Elizondo, you know, is a formerly ran a Pentagon UFO project. And they talked about this case because it's a great case, but they did show a photo, and it was this photo. And people see this out there. Often it's cropped where you just see, you don't see these lines, but you see the Capitol and these lights. Well, if you see the full photo here, and this is a photo from NICAP, they draw lines from the lights down on the street level up to the lights in the sky. Why? Because when you take a picture of something in the dark where there are lights that are overexposed like this, you'll often see kind of this in-camera kind of flare type of thing. And these aren't UFOs. These are flares. That's and right. I actually have a MUFON photo expert here to talk more about this reflection phenomenon.
Wow. Yeah, it's true. You know, and the thing about lens flares is that they're symmetric across the center of the field. So if you have a flare or an object that's up here, right, and you have another bright object on the ground and you think maybe that's the source, draw a line between it. Okay? Then if you have another one, draw a line between that and, the, and its potential source. If all the lines cross right in the very in one place, then you're actually crossing at the center of that image frame, and that's typically what happens with flares. They dance around symmetrically opposite the actual source object. So that's what I think we see in that Washington one, and in many, many hundreds and hundreds of others that I've seen over the years. But, you know, it doesn't mean that's all we have. You know, there's certainly more to it, but that's in that case, he's exactly right.
Mark, while you're on this,
pinnacle of his expertise here.
Mark, while you're talking about this, there was a great case that the Mexican Air Force got involved, and it was over oil. What do they call them?
Oil rigs.
Oil rigs offshore, and the same thing. But they actually had radar. They had radar contact. They had their camera out. And they were filming, but they also had these same refractions or something coming up from the oil derricks out there. Do you know about that particular case? Is that a similar type situation?
I don't know about that, but see the thing here. The thing with that case is I don't know that data. I haven't seen radar data from that case personally, but radar data is always a good thing to bring in. However, the problem is that sometimes photos that get taken are conflated with the actual event and may have nothing to do with the event, like that photo that Alejandro showed you moments ago with lights over the Capitol. Those really are just lens flares, right? They really are. 99.9%, I'm saying almost 100% certain that's what those are. But for Campeche, I haven't heard of that case, but
I've got more information on Campeche.
Oh, there we go.
And, of course, we have a story on this on Open Mindset TV. But you are exactly right, and a similar process was used to determine that those were the oil rigs, because I was a skeptic too. I did not think those were the oil rigs. How can these Mexican Air Force guys who are used to working these machines mistake these flames coming up from oil rigs as UFOs? I thought there's no way. But you know what? It turns out the work of Ben McGee had proven this to me. He actually did a process that's similar to what Mark described, and I'll talk about it. And then I turned out there was actually a Mexican UFO researcher who had done this at the time that those videos came out. So he had done the same thing prior. But essentially what they did was take the path of the plane, draw that on a map, and then draw lines from that position to where these oil rigs are. And as Ben McGee puts it, and he does that, we've got a story on Open Minds, and we've got Ben McGee's talk on this. I was there. He did this in Las Vegas, and he clearly demonstrates this. Well, that way you can predict the lights. So when you draw these lines, you know exactly when the plane will see what lights, and they line up perfectly.
Right.
So he was able to undeniably demonstrate that those were indeed the lights. And for me, when I saw Ben go through this process, it was like a real aha moment. It was like, oh my gosh, he just proved to me what I never thought could be true. I never thought it could be those oil rigs. But when you draw those lines, you can show they line up precisely.
Yeah. But again, it's not like you got to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
You know, there was really something going on at that time on both cases.
Yeah, I don't know if Campeche was I don't think anything was really going on in Campeche. I don't think there was a UFO incident there.
Okay, however, so we'll throw the baby out with the bathwater on that one.
Well, not necessarily. It's just all there is bathwater, that's all you got. Now, we've got a baby in Washington, D.C., because in Washington, D.C., we do have radar data. We have also a ton of witnesses, including Blue Book personnel themselves. So there's a lot more data, and we had jets scrambled to chase these things. So we have a lot more data and witness testimony when it comes to Washington, D.C. in 1952 as compared to the Campeche case.
I see. Hey, going back to the case we were talking about, the very first one at that lock in Baltimore, I believe it was.
Yeah.
So that one, you and I were talking on your show about the professor of history that looks into UFOs. And by the way, he is going to be on the show, by the way. don't think he's been on any shows. I haven't seen him. I looked all through everywhere. I couldn't find him on anything. So it's taken a chance, but a professor of history ought to be very interesting when it comes to UFOs.
You beat me to another one.
I did.
Yeah, you know, that's the sort of thing where I feel that you can't lose, that someone like that is going to say something interesting. I noticed he wrote some stories for the Smithsonian, and he does seem to draw a correlation between people claiming to have alien experiences and the movies, especially Close Encounters, coming out with alien-type characters. So it sounds like he's a bit skeptical in that arena. However, he's definitely into the topic, and I think what he'll have to share is going to be fascinating. So that's a good job. Good job on getting him.
Yeah. Well, it's just an email. Hey, Alejandro. Hey, you and Mark.
But you still had the...
Oh, wait. You still have to tell me what you guys are going to do after the show.
So, Mark, and I don't know if he can explain to you how, but let me have him explain.
All right.
Oh, sure. Well, you know what? When you do things like we do, we talk and we investigate UFOs, sometimes you have to have an outlet. And one of my outlets that I like that I really think is amazing is primal music. That is the Aboriginal music from Australia. And you think about what kind of instruments they use. They use these things that were basically termite hollowed logs. And they would create this, you know, rawr, 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 rawr sound. And that sound is generated by a standing wave inside the tube, it's called. But don't worry about that. It's actually called a didgeridoo. And the didgeridoo can and has been used for a long time, centuries, actually, to create and stories in the dream time in Aboriginal culture. So tonight we're actually going to make didgeridoos. We're going to take a little modern approach. We're going to actually use PVC pipe, which can be used as well.
But you have to breathe special, right?
Yeah. You have to do circular breathing, which is basically like you constantly are breathing out of your mouth while taking breath in through your nose. So if your listeners want to try that, let them try it. But, you know, make sure you hold on to something because you might pass out if you're trying to do that too much. But
wow.
It's pretty cool. But that's what we're going to do. We're going to build didgeridoos, and we got a group of people that are getting together tonight to do it.
Wow.
That sounds really
new agey type of stuff to me. But
it
sounds like
it
fun,
might sound
too.
Sounds new agey, maybe, but the Aborigines have been doing it for centuries.
No, I'm interested. I'm just giving you a hard time. All right, you two guys, thanks. Thanks so much for checking in, and have fun with your didgeridoos.
We will.
All right.
Well, didgeridoo just for you.
All right. Can't wait. All right. Talk to you next week.
All right. See ya.
Bye. All right, everyone. So our guest is Nick Redfern. He's always a pleasure to have on the show. And this week, we are going to be talking about his 50th book. You heard it right, 50th book. He really puts out a lot of work. And this one is called Top Secret Alien Abduction Files, What the Government Doesn't Want You to Know. Nick, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, Martin. I'm doing good, thanks. How's things?
Very good. Good, as always. I've always talked to you about, you're the only one I know that is so disciplined to write. How does it feel to get to your 50th book? Must be amazing.
I don't know, really. I mean, if you asked me when I did the first book in 97, that 20 years later I'd have done 50, I'd have probably said there's no way. But you know, I mean, it's what I enjoy doing, you know, and it's one of these situations where I'm sort of pretty driven in the way that I write the books. For example, I like to sort of stick to what I call working hours. So I usually get up about 7, have some breakfast, and answer emails, mess around on Facebook, and then I do writing for the books and the magazines from 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. But evenings and weekends, I can literally completely switch off. I don't do any work on evenings. I don't work any weekends. That's for me, evenings and weekends, for having a good time. And but I, you know, I do put in like an 8-hour day, Monday to Friday, like just like a regular job. But I wouldn't want people to think that I consider it just a job. You know, for me, it's a passion that I turned into a career as well. And for me, as long as I have that passion, that excitement, that sort of sense of wow, you know, this is really interesting, I've got to investigate this. As long as all that, I'll keep doing it, you know what I mean? Because it's what I enjoy doing, whether it's investigating Bigfoot, Chupacabra, UFO encounters. So, yes, you know, as long as I'm happy doing it, and I can keep coming up with new material, which is an important thing. You don't want to just keep going over old ground.
That was my next question. I was going to ask you, how do you come up with the topics that you come up with? And when you're talking about this discipline work that you do, the 9-to-5, so to speak, how do you do that when it comes to the research? I mean, you know, boots on the ground, like you may have to go somewhere and look at files or something like that. Do you kind of keep it the same way, or is that in a whole different way?
Yeah, that actually is pretty much a lot different. I mean, for the most part, you know, I am sort of working from home during the day. But yeah, if I'm sort of going out somewhere, you know, so let's say hypothetically, I mean, I live just outside Dallas, and if somebody phones me up and says, you know, I've got a really interesting story, pictures, etc., and they're down in Houston, which is like a 5-hour drive from me, then yeah, that'll be totally different. You know, I'll go down there and just grab a room for overnight, you know, and chat with the witness, and so that's sort of totally different, yeah. But in terms of actually doing the research, you know, and coming up with new ideas, I mean, I guess I take sort of like a journalistic approach of just digging out stories, you know, and particularly if somebody shares a story and they're okay about using it, and then I'll sort of look further into the story and further and get further leads and additional sources and contacts, and the story then starts to kind of build itself, you know, it sort of has its own momentum almost.
I see. Now, about topics, though, how does that, do you like, do you test that by talking to people, or how do you figure out how to, you know, how to come up with a topic that's your next?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, sometimes it's purely and simply because there's something that I really want to write about. And so that's what I do. But then there are other occasions where a story falls in my lap, which is like, wow, that's a really cool story. And I look into it further and find a lot of other cool aspects to the story. And so, you know, then I pursue it further. Sometimes, you know, you just stumble on something by mistake, or, you know, whether you're not even trying. And the more you look into it, the more you think, wow, you know, there's X number of people who know something about this, but they've never really shared their story. And again, if they're fine with the stories being told, etc. But a lot of it, I guess, sort of comes from me having particular interests in certain areas and just, you know, just digging around for things that fall into those categories, like Bigfoot or lake monsters, Chupacabra, Men in Black. I just, you know, sort of pursue leads, really, and then expand them to like a book length, I guess.
So how did this particular book, Alien Abduction Files, how did that begin?
Well, yeah, I mean, with this book, like with any book, you know, I'm not just somebody who writes books. I always also read books, you know. And of course, if you're going to read a book and write a book, you want the audience to think, well, this is a good book. Not only is it a good book, but it's new material or a new slant or a new angle on the subject. And I think that's important. You know, if you're writing books, you have a responsibility to your readership to give them something new with each book. So with this particular book, Top Secret Alien Abduction Files, now, over the years and decades, dozens and dozens of books have been written on alien abductions. You know, you've got like John Fuller's The Interrupted Journey back in the 60s on the Betty and Barney Hill case, Bud Hopkins' Missing Time, which was like sort of one of the definitive books on the subject around 79, 80, 81, and of course Whitley Strieber's Communion, the late John Mack, his books, and so on. And the subject of abductions interests me anyway, But the one angle that I'd heard snippets of, and I think a lot of people have heard snippets of, but had not been really fleshed out to any significant degree, was what government agencies may know about abductions, about abductees, about the agenda that's involved. And so I did what I always do. I sort of take a journalistic approach, tried to track down as many people who'd made comments on this or had experiences, you know, with people from the government asking them about their abductions. And again, just sort of, you know, developed a situation where more and more data came forward and to the point where I was able to make, you know, a full manuscript that presented a new, well, not so much a new angle, but new data demonstrating this connection between government agencies and what they know about abductions. And but to demonstrate that this is, you know, an important and intriguing aspect of the phenomenon, namely not just the nature of the abductions and the abductees, but looking at how and why government agencies are concerned by this as well.
Great. Okay. Well, hey, Nick, we're at our first break, so we're going to go to break. And so we'll hold that thought and we'll come back to it.
All right.
All right. So this is Martin with Podcast UFO, and my guest is Nick Redfern. And we'll be right back. Nick, I mentioned to you that we'll chat about off-topic, so we'll get back to the topic we were on. So I was just trying to think of something different to talk to you about while we're on break. And if this is too personal, just please let me know. But I wondered how you came about coming to live in the United States and end up near Dallas.
Oh, yeah, that's no problem. That's not a problem at all.
Okay. So... Yeah. So how did that all fall into place?
Oh, sorry, I thought you meant you wanted to keep that for the show.
Oh no, this is break stuff.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, yeah, this was 2001. I'd been over to the United States as far back as 1998 for like lectures and conferences, but one of the people I met during the course of sort of doing the whole conference scene and so on was a guy named Ryan Wood. And Ryan was someone who used to investigate all the Majestic 12 documents with his dad, Dr. Bob Wood, and they did a huge amount of work on this. Mm-hmm. And one occasion, it was like just over a couple of beers at the bar, Ryan said, you know, I'm looking for someone who can work for me full-time doing research and investigations and looking into these documents and tracking down people who might know anything about it. And, you know, I was in the UK then, and, you know, I didn't have any ties or anything like that at all. And so he basically said to me, you know, he said, would you be interested? And I said, well, yeah, sure. And, you know, as I said, I enjoy sort of just traveling around here and there. I've never been one to worry about, you know, not putting roots down. I'm fine with, you know, just wherever the things take me, you know.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And so I basically went through the whole immigration process and, you know, which took about 18 months. But during that period, you know, I think about 4 months after I first applied with the immigration people, you know, I was given a social security number and then permission to work, etc. So that then, obviously, Ryan had to wait until, you know, I was legally able to do all this. And then I became fully legal, like about 18 months after that. And that's how it all began, really. It was just pure coincidence or fate, however you want to term it, that I happened to be at the conference at the same time Ryan was looking for someone to work for him full time, and I was someone who didn't have any particular ties that would, you know, prevent me from doing it and prevent me from sort of traveling around the country and doing research for him.
Wow, perfect. All right, everyone, welcome back. My guest tonight is Nick Redfern on YouTube. The show does play on the Dark Matter Digital Network on Thursdays as well. Hello to everyone over there. There's a lot of people listen over there. Nick, before we went to break, you were talking about, you know, the interests that certain government agencies. Are you talking about government agencies in which countries or all countries that are other, several countries, I mean?
Well, the ones I focus on in the book are the United States and the UK. Mm-hmm. And that's primarily because, you know, being familiar and coming from the UK and living in the US, you know, I'm more familiar with the events in those nations. So in that sense, you know, I've focused on some cases which are overseas in other countries, but predominantly, you know, I do sort of focus in the on the US primarily and then the UK.
And so can you go into a little bit about, now the title of your book, of course, is Abduction mm-hmm. Files, and that kind of insinuates, at least to me, that you're talking about some possible documents that came out of a Freedom of Information Act or something like that, or that have been unclassified now or something?
Yeah, that's exactly what it's about. You know, people have said to me, well, several people have said words to the effect of, well, when, like, just like you said, when you're talking about files, you're talking about documentation rather than just witness testimony. I said, yes. Now, I start the book with the whole contactee movement of the 1950s. You know, we had the contactees in the 50s, and then the 60s onwards, you had the abduction phenomenon with the abductees. Now, the reason why I do this is because through the Freedom of Information Act, the FBI, for example, have been very good at declassifying their previously classified files on many of the early contactees, like George Adamski, Truman Bethlehem, George Van Tassel, Orfeo Angelusi, and George Hunt Williamson. They were some of the early contactees. And for people who don't know what the contactees are, basically, in the early 50s, rather than having people abducted by these sort of bug-eyed little creatures, people talked about having been invited by what we would call the so-called Space Brothers. Now, the best way I can sort of describe the Space Brothers is that they were sort of long-haired, very human-looking, and in many respects, looking just like us. And one of the important things about this is that many of the Space Brothers told the so-called contactees, like Adamski, that one of their big concerns was the threat of atomic war. And so what you had was a situation where people were following, people like George Adamski developed huge followings. And so what you had was a situation where the FBI got very concerned because people like George Adamski were saying that many of the Space Brothers had a form of government not unlike communism. And of course, this was the 50s, you know, McCarthyism and so on. And as a result, the FBI got very concerned that some of these contactees were sort of swaying people around to communism, and that's why many of these files were opened. But the important thing is, the files were opened also because the contactees were claiming human-alien interaction. So I mention all this in the book because it demonstrates, despite some people have said that the government's never investigated people who claim to have, you know, seen aliens, well, that's not the case. I mean, George Adamski's FBI file is about 150 pages long. George Van Tassel's is more than 300 pages. Then I could go on and on. And so that work, that sort of demonstrates, if you like, the there was a precedent, if you like, to the abductions, namely in the form of the contactees.
Nick, do you think a lot of that had to do with just the fact that they could gather such a large crowd and had such influence on a large crowd of people? I mean, do you think that's part of why I personally would think that's part of why the FBI would have a file on them. I'm sure they do on, religious and cult leaders, the same thing. Well, Nick's phone went dead for a little while, so I thought it'd be a good place to end the show for the free part of the show, and I want to thank you all for listening. Anyone can help us out. And for $2 or more a month, you can listen to the full 2-hour shows, plus the archives. And it's all set up for media players of all sorts as well. And you can make a payment also once a year if you'd like. All that information's on podcastufo.com. And I wouldn't be doing this, believe me, if this show didn't cost some money for a weekly for my show producer, plus all the other expenses, including bandwidth and dedicated server and all these different things I have to have. So anyway, it's just barely in the black, and that's okay. It's in the black right now, and so that's good. So anyway, I do thank you for listening. I do appreciate all listeners of this show. And we'll be back next week with Alejandro Rojas. So remember to keep your eyes to the sky.